Welcome to Now You Know. I'm Catherine Sussman. Today, my guest is Dr. Anne Russin, primatologist and professor of psychology at Glendon College, York University, Toronto. Anne's research has focused on observational field studies of orangutan behavior in Indonesian Borneo. She is also advisor to several orangutan support organizations around the globe and is the advisor to Love Nature's highest rated series, Orangutan Jungle School, about to premiere its second season on December 1st. It's such a pleasure to have you on the show today. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you for the invitation. Orangutans are my favorite topic, so it's always great to have an excuse to do more of that.
Well, this is such a treat for me. I just spent the weekend with my 8-year-old daughter binge watching the show, Orangutan Jungle School, and we both just fell in love with it. Very sad to hear that they're critically endangered now, but very much looking forward to the opportunity to chat with you about this today and see how people can help.
Yeah, great. Yeah. And of course, you know, this is Orangutan Jungle School 2.
Right.
So there is also Orangutan Jungle School 1, if you haven't seen that.
Well, that's what we were binge watching, actually.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So we're all hooked up.
So you're all ready for the new one.
We're all ready for season 2. Looking forward to it. So, Anne, just to begin with, how long have you been working with great apes and specifically orangutans?
Great apes. Well, let's do orangutans first because that's easy. It's almost exactly 30 years.
Wow.
I worked with infant chimpanzees for a few years before that, but they were in captivity. In fact, that was my first experience spending any time with great apes. And what happened was I absolutely loved the chimps and I absolutely hated captivity. So when I decided to go ahead, I was looking for a field site where I could go study great apes in the wild. And as it happened, I went to Indonesia before I went to Africa and ended up studying orangutans. I ended up in Borneo.
And can you tell me, obviously, just from anybody who's had the opportunity to observe orangutans, whether in captivity or through a show or film, obviously it's quite clear how remarkable they are. But from your perspective, can you describe why you're so drawn to them and what makes them so remarkable to you?
With all the great apes I've had anything to do with, and I've seen them all, the thing that is most interesting to me is how highly intelligent they are. And it's not just the really high intelligence, because you know dogs can be extraordinarily smart and whales and dolphins are extraordinarily smart. But all the great apes, chimps, orangutans, gorillas, and bonobos are our closest living relatives. And their intelligence is very much like our own. So it's like looking at yourself in a funny mirror and seeing somebody who looks very different from you, but at the same time is so very much the same. And I suppose one of the things I like best about the intelligence part of it is that orangutans can outsmart humans any day of the week.
Really?
An orangutan can fool the same person with the same joke 5 times over. And we still don't get it.
What really struck my daughter and me as we were watching the first series was just how incredibly social and almost needy they seem to be with each other. They're just so incredibly loving with one another and physically attached to each other. Is that because these are orphans, or is that just the way that it is with orangutans in the wild as well?
Well, with the ones you see on Orangutan Jungle School, the main reason is that they're kids. They're little kids who would normally be with their mother. So they're just dying for some adult to come and help them figure out how the world works. And I think that explains a lot their much more sociable way of life when you see them in Orangutan Jungle School than anything you would see in the forest. They're little kids, and in this case, again, orphan, and they really need and really value having other orangutans or big humans to help them figure out how things work. It's scary out there in the forest, you know?
Absolutely.
You want to be in the forest out there all by yourself? That's really scary. So it really helps to have a friend with you.
Is this correct? It takes 8 years to rehabilitate them for release from the sanctuary. Is that how long they would be dependent on their mothers in the wild?
Well, I think the 8 years may be an estimate of, you know, if you got them at birth, how long it would be before you could possibly consider letting them go free in the forest. The reason is, in wild orangutans, youngsters are finally become able to be independent when they're 7 to 8 years old. So up to that point, they're always under the care of their mother. They're growing, and of course, they're learning a lot. So if you got an infant orangutan in that had been captured when they were just a few weeks old, yes, you could very well be looking at taking care of them for 8 years. On the other hand, if you got a five-year-old who already had a lot of forest experience, maybe only about three. So it varies with the individual.
So Jess, can you give us a wider picture of the state of orangutans generally? Where are they found throughout the world, and why are they so critically endangered?
Well, in modern times, wild orangutans, as far back as modern history knows, have only been on the islands of Borneo and Sumatra. So 90% of orangutans are in the country of Indonesia, because Indonesia governs all of Sumatra and most of Borneo. But there are two small areas in North Borneo, Sarawak and Sabah, that are part of Malaysia. So those are the only places that we now find modern wild orangutans. In history, evolutionary history, we know that they came from continental Southeast Asia. So for example, they have found fossils of ancestral orangutans in Vietnam and I think up as far as southern China. So there is evidence that they had lived in farther north areas and then migrated to the south. Now, if you want to talk about orangutans in general, of course, if you're talking captive orangutans, we can now find them anywhere in the world because zoos all over the place and laboratories have them.
So that was going to be my next. Yeah, that was going to be my next question to you. And actually, I grew up here in Toronto, and I remember being taken to the Toronto Zoo, and the exhibit that I would spend the longest at always with my siblings was the orangutans. And it's so interesting looking back in hindsight how different my perspective is on that now. At the time, we were just really not taught to think from their point of view. They were just fascinating to watch. They were so human-like. But you know, we were not thinking, how are they feeling in there? Basically, yeah. Incarcerated.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that's a very common experience. When I was a kid, I remember we went to a zoo in a little city nearby. And as kids, we were just absolutely thrilled to see all kinds of creatures we'd never seen before. And there was never any consideration of the fact that it might be a really lousy deal for the animals that were stuck in rotten little cages. So I think you're not unusual in thinking you just see something interesting. But I personally am very glad that views are changing. And we're now starting to think that that is not an appropriate thing to do with probably any animal, but certainly not with great apes.
Absolutely. Can you give me a sense of the percentage of orangutans that are in captivity compared to those that are left in the wild?
I frankly don't know, but I think the estimates of wild orangutans, and I'm probably wrong on this as well, may be something like in total 50, 60,000 left surviving in the wild. Are there that many in captivity? Somehow I doubt it, but I could be wrong.
That's not a lot of animals.
That is not very much at all.
So getting into the specifics of what is causing them to be endangered, could you talk a bit about deforestation as well as the illegal pet trade and also these animals being killed for food?
Yeah, sure. But I think the first point to make is that the reason that they're endangered is us, it's humans. All of the things that you mentioned and more are human-caused, deliberate human-caused assaults on orangutans. Sometimes it's not deliberately an assault on orangutans, but it's an assault on things that they need to survive. So we're basically killing them off. The kinds of things that happen, certainly cutting down forests, one of the big ones these days, and anybody who follows the news probably knows about it, is destroying habitat, destroying Bornean forest to put in oil palm plantations to make oils that we sell and use in a lot of our domestic products. Other damage comes from tearing down forests to put in plantations of other agricultural crops, or sometimes trees that are preferred for pulpwood or for construction. Also, there is damage for resource extraction, the same kinds of things that we have in Canada. And in fact, if you live in Canada, if you use us as an example, you can understand very well what's going on in Borneo, because we mine for oil, gas, coal, diamonds, gold, and all of those resources are found on Borneo. And you can imagine then the same degree of destruction happens in Borneo that happens in Canada with industries that are taking out resources, non-renewable resources, from typically from underground.
And how dire is that situation right now in Indonesia? What is the political climate like in terms of deforestation? That might be a little bit outside of the realm of your expertise.
Well, but the one that I don't follow it as closely as I should, but the issue of oil palms is clearly a very serious one. One of the things that's been going on, I mean, there was a while when the government was putting much stricter regulations on oil palm plantations, so big plantations that were owned by the oil palm corporations. And there is a responsible oil palm organization that is meant to try and do a better job. That's all very well, but what the oil palm plantation owners have gone and done is farm out the growing and harvesting of oil palms to local people, to smallholders. So what happens is, instead of having a huge plantation where the government can put on a lot of good restrictions, is you now have thousands and thousands of small farmers who are doing whatever they like on their own small piece of land or whatever land they can use. And it is extraordinarily difficult and probably impossible to regulate it. So it becomes something like guerrilla warfare, that regulating oil palm plantations is now probably almost impossible because it's moved to a local level and it's much more difficult to police or control.
Such a dire situation.
Yes, it's terrible.
So how did Nauru, can you pronounce it for me, Bentang Sanctuary, how did it come about?
Nauru.
Oh, thank you.
Nauru. You got to stick a little Y in there.
Nauru.
N-Y, Nauru.
Nauru.
Right, now you got it. Okay. How did it come about? Okay. It is one of two major orangutan rehabilitation projects. The first one was in East Borneo, which is where I got to know them back in the early 1990s. Nyaro Menteng was established, I think, in about 1999, 2000, something like that, for Central Kalimantan. You know, orangutans are all the way across the island of Borneo. And in fact, central Kalimantan, central Indonesian Borneo, is the province with the most orangutans and an awful lot of destruction because of industrial expansion. So they set up Nyawa Menteng as a new orangutan rehabilitation center in the center of that province.
And how did you get involved with this particular?
Well, I was involved with the people who, the Boss Foundation, who established their first orangutan rehabilitation center in East Kalimantan. And I had the opportunity, I did research there on the ex-captive orangutans. I had the opportunity to go and do similar research with the Nyaro Menteng orangutans and thought it was an opportunity that was too good to pass up. So I moved up there in 2003 with my research team, and we stayed there for two and a half years studying the orangutans that are being rehabilitated to forest life through Nyaro Menteng. And in fact, they were orangutans on small islands, put on small islands to allow them the chance for semi-independent life. And Orangutan Jungle School, well, before Orangutan Jungle School, there was Orangutan Island 1 and 2, made by the same New Zealand Natural History Unit, and they shot their first series on Orangutan Island, on one of the islands where we were studying ex-captives being rehabilitated. So I met Judith back way back in something like about 2005, I think, as she was getting ready or trying to think about what she might possibly do to film these orangutans.
And this is the largest primate rescue and rehabilitation project in the world. Is that correct?
I frankly don't know. It could very well be, but I haven't seen any statistics in quite a while, so I couldn't guarantee, but it could very well be.
It just seems like the most idyllic place. I just want to spend my entire life there. My daughter's begging me now to take a trip.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
It's certainly fascinating. It's certainly fascinating.
And I think it's just brilliant that you're involved with a show as well, that Love Nature is doing this series to really expose everybody, and in particular children, to the attributes and just the general daily life of these animals. It's really unbelievable. It's a great way to get people aware.
I certainly agree that it's a great way to get people interested and to entirely captivate them as to how wonderful orangutans are. Now, most of the orangutans you see in Orangutan Jungle Scale, of course, their school are, of course, like kindergartners or nursery school kids. And adult orangutans are a different deal. But certainly the little kids are funny. They are charming. They're smart as whips. They come up with the craziest ideas. And yes, it's absolutely wonderful.
I think one of the best parts about the show is that it really elucidates for people the reason why legal personhood should be granted to great apes and other sentient species. I was wondering if you would be able to talk a little bit about Sandra, the 33-year-old orangutan from Buenos Aires who was recently granted legal personhood by an Argentinian judge.
Yes, I probably don't know a whole lot more about Sandra than you do, but I know it was a case that was in the works in South America for a long time, and Sandra was granted legal personhood, but they had nowhere to keep her in South America. So there is a primate sanctuary in Florida that agreed to take Sandra, and Sandra has recently arrived there. To my knowledge, and I know the people who run the sanctuary in Florida, it's a really super sanctuary, and it's wonderful that Sandra has been able to come there. Patty Reagan, who runs the sanctuary in Florida, I know does her absolute best to create an environment that's safe for all of the primates that are there and tries to provide them as much opportunity for rich lives as she can. So, I mean, you're still one way or another stuck in caves or enclosures, but you've got lots of stuff to play with. You get to eat things that you like and when you like. There's other orangutans you can socialize with. The keepers that are there are probably really nice people who engage as much as possible. So I think it's really wonderful that she's now in a place where she'll be getting the best care that she probably could.
That sounds a lot better than what the conditions were like in Argentina for her. So that's great.
I suspect so. Yes, yes.
I was wondering if you could explain for people listening who might not know what legal personhood is as opposed to the status of being an animal and why orangutans deserve this status.
Yeah. Personhood in law apparently is based on the idea of what qualifies as a person to philosophers. And a person to a philosopher is an individual who can control and govern their own life. They can be autonomous and make their own decisions. Now, orangutans, lots of animals, are autonomous and make their own decisions. So by that definition, they should be considered to qualify as persons. And being a person is important because under the law, if you are a person, you are entitled to protection under the law. So very important to qualify as a person because that changes the way in which you're going to be treated by the authorities in whatever country you're in.
So we obviously do not have that in place here in Canada yet. And if we were to have the law change, so we did grant legal personhood to apes, what would that mean for apes that we currently have in the country? How would that change things for them?
I think, like with Sandra, the best you could do for individuals who've been basically incarcerated for a long period of time or basically effectively for their whole lives is ensure that the living conditions that are provided for them are the best that are possible. So like Sandra, for other apes that are in captivity, best would be to ensure that they can be sent to some kind of a sanctuary that provides them the kind of care that's appropriate for their species. And for example, in the United States, it would mean you could take a chimpanzee that was living in somebody's small cage in the basement, a private person's small cage in the basement, you could say, look, this is inappropriate care for this individual. So although it makes sense, we can't really let them go back into the wild. You could say at least we should at least provide this individual with better care and some kind of sanctuary that understands the species and provides the best care possible is where they should go.
Do you know if people are legally allowed to have an orangutan as a pet in Canada? Like, is that part of the exotic pet trade? I know that municipally, depending on where you are, you cannot have any kind of ape or specific species, but depending on what municipality you're in, the law is very wide open.
I think that is the unfortunate part of it, is there is no universal law in Canada that controls what kinds of species you can own. And if you remember Darwin, the IKEA monkey, he was taken, he was confiscated, and is now under sanctuary care. But that was in the Toronto area.
Right.
And apparently the person who had, in quotes, owned him to start with, has simply moved to other municipalities where the laws are not as strict, and has continued to purchase and own other monkeys. So yeah, the problem is here, we don't have any laws that are broad enough to cover the whole country and ensure that you can guarantee or control the kinds of care that captives are subjected to.
And in terms of research, it's my understanding that we no longer test on apes. Is that correct in Canada, in labs?
I think that's true. And there are now some labs that are also reducing their use of monkeys as test species. And again, I partly know that through some monkeys that have been sent to a sanctuary just outside Toronto from laboratories. So they've been retired from the laboratories and are being moved to a place that can give them better care. So there is some move to recognizing that maybe even with monkeys that were also primates, we should not be subjecting them to the kind of treatment that we've subjected them to in the past.
And certainly monkeys and apes of different types are found in zoos across our country. So if we could have some sort of change made federally, that would hopefully help those
that
animals.
Would be.
And just for people listening that may go to visit zoos, if I think back to the Toronto Zoo exhibit, the orangutan exhibit there, I mean, just basic knowledge, I mean, they're indoors. They don't seem to have any exposure to the natural world at all in terms of, you know, sunlight, natural fresh air, that kind of thing. But could you just tell us, if we look at those animals in particular, because that I assume is one of the better exhibits as well, what is wrong with that exhibit? Why is that so inappropriate for an orangutan?
Well, among other things, as you noted, they have no option of being outside. It's now about 40 years that zoo has been in operation. Since the mid-1970s, so 40 years, they haven't seen the outside.
Horrible.
I think it's terribly sad. On the side of zoos or organizations, it is, of course, extremely expensive to create outdoor enclosures that would make it possible to be outside. So from their perspective, I can understand this is not something that you can do in a day. And I also appreciate, you know, there are issues of security and safety and all of those kinds of things. And the trouble with great apes as well is they're tropical species. So year-round outdoor enclosures are clearly not on the map because there are times of the year when they couldn't, for their own health, and probably even wouldn't want to be outdoors. But yes, given that it's been so long since they did the gorilla enclosure, it certainly would have been nicer to see an orangutan enclosure, an orangutan outdoor enclosure before now. The real difficult job for zoos is creating a social world that is comfortable for them. So clearly part of it is, you know, mums and kids being together. That works. And for kids, having other kids there to play with, that's obviously very important. The trouble is, as you get older, adolescents and then adults get to be competitive. So you might have liked your sister when she was a little kid, but as an adult, she's not your best friend anymore.
Right.
So keeping families together, sometimes it doesn't work very well. And for purposes of breeding, because given that zoos have had big programs in captive breeding, the question is where you can send the younger maturing males and females so that when they mate, you don't end up with problems of inbreeding.
Right.
So the decision of who goes where is not entirely in the zoo's hands, on top of the fact that it's really difficult to juggle relationships as individuals grow older. So very difficult to create a social world that is agreeable and stable for the individuals that are actually there. Generally speaking, the social world, very difficult to construct it and manage it so everybody is happy. Very difficult to create a physical world that provides what they need to keep their bodies in good shape, to keep them interested, to allow them to function in a species normal way. So those are the kinds of things that are wrong.
And Anne, what actions can people take to help orangutans?
Well, there are lots of NGOs that are working specifically with orangutans. For example, the people that run the rehab centers in Borneo that are filmed on Orangutan Jungle School, they all are very pleased to accept donations. And funding is also always very important in terms of making sure that you can do a good job. You can often adopt an orangutan. Other cases, there are other NGOs that work internationally. For example, there is an orangutan conservancy in the US. There is the Borneo Orangutan Society Canada, which is us here in Canada. I think there is an Orangutan Foundation International in Canada too, out in British Columbia. And then there are, of course, all of the larger wildlife agencies that you could consider donating to if you're interested is in the much broader issue of saving the planet's wildlife in general, rather than focusing on any specific species.
Well, thank you so much for all of that information. And we'll get that up on our website when we put out this podcast as well to try to help. And for people listening, again, Orangutan Jungle School Season 2 airs Sundays at 8 p.m. starting December 1st on Love Nature during the channel's 8-week free preview event, which runs from November 4th to January 5th. Across the country. So, Anne, thank you so much for being here. It was wonderful to have the chance to learn from you today. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thanks a lot. And very nice to speak to you as well.